Right, everyone, welcome back. This is episode 15, no, episode 16 of Christian History and Ideas. Episode 16. And we are continuing. This is the fourth episode on the topic of Jerusalem. And we are continuing in this line of thinking with the development of pilgrimage in the post-Nicene days, I guess we could say, and looking at various autographs that we have and recollections from people. Before we get going, we like to kick these things off with a verse and somewhat topical to whatever we might be getting through. So this is from the book of Hebrews, chapter 12, verse 22. It often appears at Vespers on Sundays, I believe. You have approached Mount Zion, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and countless angels in festal gathering, and the assembly of the firstborn enrolled in heaven, and God, the judge of all, and the spirits of just men made perfect, and Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. And the sprinkled blood that speaks more eloquently than that of Abel. Once again, Hebrews 12, 22 through 24 there, but that puts us in, well, the right line of thinking to continue our discussion. And Dr. Das, one of the questions that I had myself, and we always invite viewer questions too, you may write us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. But one of my questions was, is pilgrimage at this hour? We're talking about the first half of the fourth century, time of Saint Helena, Constantine, this sort of thing. Is and maybe the couple of generations afterwards, is pilgrimage simply a Western or Roman concept or phenomena, we'll say, at this time? Or do we have evidence of people from the Persian Empire or from Africa, things like this, also accruing the consciousness of pilgrimage, of holy journey?
Yes, we do have, interestingly enough, we do have evidence for Christian pilgrimage from the eastern parts of the Roman Empire. We have, for example, evidence from Syria of people going into Jerusalem as pilgrims. And we also have evidence from Egypt, from Christian communities there going to pilgrimage at this time, or a little later on, to Jerusalem as pilgrims. And interestingly enough, this is jumping ahead quite a bit. I just thought of it. Interestingly enough, one of the ways of marking yourself off as a holy pilgrim in the East is to take on this title of pilgrim in front of your family name. This is often using the Islamic term haji. So people become hajis, Christian hajis, who are from the East. And in order to show off or demonstrate that they have done this, they then put haji in front of their first in front of their family names. So Haji so and so. And interestingly enough, you often find this in contemporary Greek names. The term haji, in Greek it's chatzi. And it's used as a way of telling people that, yes, I've been to, either Jerusalem or a sacred spot or a pilgrim. I've undertaken a sacred pilgrimage. So this idea of pilgrimage in the East is, of course, just as pronounced and just as important as in the West. So people do come to Jerusalem from both directions, and the South as well. From Northern Africa, because remember, Northern Africa at this time is thoroughly Christian because it's thoroughly Roman, it's going to become thoroughly Germanic afterward, in about 300 years with the Vandals and so forth invading. But that's a different story. But yes, we have evidence of different pilgrims. We even have pilgrims, evidence of pilgrims from the Slavic countries, and you know, quite early on, and you know, well, not quite early on, but in the, you know, 9th century or so, by the time they get converted, because they don't get converted until you know, the 800s. So we have evidence from all directions to this holy place, for sure.
And, you know, in the context of the 4th century, and I think back to previous episodes in this show here, when we've, especially around Alexander, and we've had occasion to talk about doctrinal disputes and various things which led to Nicaea. Do you think, Dr. Das, that the popularization and the development of the concept of pilgrimage at this time is in response to heresies?
Yes, that's a great question, because at this time as well, and we've talked about it earlier in our shows, there's a lot of ferment going on, i.e. there's a lot of controversy. And the main ones are the various messianic points of view that are kicking around in these areas, i.e. centered around who Jesus is. You know, some people say, they're Trinitarian, say Jesus is God. Other ones who are anti-Trinitarian saying, no, he's just some nice guy. And these two are creating different kinds of heresies, even among the Trinitarians who confess Jesus as God. Even among them, there's a lot of confessional differences, let's put it that way. And these differences are becoming serious splits into various factions and so forth. So this idea of codifying the faith is very, as a very fundamental process of also combating the various splits that are happening, the heresies that are coming around. And some of these are very serious heresies, because as we know, and we've talked about it and mentioned it briefly, these heresies are going to have very, you know, long-lasting afterlife, because it's out of these heresies that Islam is going to emerge, because Islam is a codification of various anti-Trinitarian heresies that were kicking around in the East. So yes, pilgrimage is a way to counter that process, because it's creating a lot of disunity among Christians. So much so that, you know, people are saying, you know, there's all kinds of Christianities. You know, there's a very famous one, famous book called Lost Christianities, which discusses all of these various factions and splits and so forth that were happening at this time. So pilgrimage, and as we will look at liturgies, are going to help us codify. And by codify, I don't mean creating the religion itself, but codify in the sense of bringing people together that are being split apart by differences. And often these differences are, you know, they run deep and they're causing all kinds of problems. For yes, so by undertaking holy work, such as pilgrimage, it is meant to bring people together. The other aspect is going to be monasticism, the development of that. That's going to be another way of combating this process as well. So I see the two going hand in hand, actually. Monasticism and pilgrimage are going to play key roles, and they're going to be working hand in glove to further the faith, for sure.
And we will touch a little bit on the development of monasticism later in this episode. You know, last episode, Dr. Das, episode 15, we talked about, you know, the different concept of a holy place from the pagan concept to the Christian. And as we reprise our conversation directly from the last episode where we talked about Algeria, and we're going to move right now into the Bordeaux itinerary, I'm also impressed that there's also this difference of, you know, historicity of that physical, you know, place that someone can go. That too, I see as being another difference than, you know, the classical world's religions.
For sure, yes, because that's going to create some really important ideas as to how Christianity is not simply adopting the Hellenism, but replacing it. And that's a very important concept that's going to be developing at this time.
And let us turn in terms of concrete markers in the past, let us turn our attention to the Bordeaux itinerary. What do we know about this, and how does it enrich our understanding of the developing idea of pilgrimage in the fourth century?
Yes, like I said in our last show, this is the very first evidence we have of Christians undertaking a holy journey to Jerusalem to see, you know, the land of the land where Christ lived and preached and died and resurrected. This is one of the very first ones, and this itinerary is an anonymous one. We don't know who took it. We don't know who wrote it, so we can't put a pin a name on this one, as we could through Egeria. And very briefly, why we know it's Egeria, or why we think it's Egeria, is because of a Spanish monk by the name of Valerius of Bierza, and he's writing about 630 AD, so about 300 years after Egeria, and he mentions that the person who wrote this itinerary was named either Egeria or Itheria. So, you know, we don't know which one it is. By common practice, it's referred to as Egeria, but it's also known as, you know, as the itinerary of Itheria, or Peregrinatio Itheriae. There's the two names for that, but unfortunately, with the Burgundy itinerary, with the Bordeaux itinerary, we don't know who the person is that wrote it. But we do know it's very early. It dates from about 334 to 334, 333 to 334 AD. Why we know that is because through internal evidence. This internal evidence gives us a very precise date. So we're talking about immediately after Saint Helena brings back historicity to this area. From last time, we may recall that she had done this by about 328 AD, and this is happening about 3 years afterwards. So what we can then imagine is that how quickly the word has spread about this holy place. It's no longer just another Roman city, but it's now a Christian sacred city. It's become a holy place, i.e., we're now into this idea of holy land, the Christian holy land. And because we have this notion of the Christian holy land, the word has spread, and the word has spread far and wide. Because as we know, Bordeaux is in France, near the Atlantic. And that's a far way away to go, to come from. To head out to Jerusalem, and what this also then tells us that the word has spread far and wide about this idea of, well, two things: the idea of Jerusalem as a holy place, and this idea of pilgrimage. So historically, the Bordeaux itinerary is the record of the very first Christian pilgrim to the Holy Land that we have, and as such, it's very important. And what it does, of course, is that it lays out the journey, and it lays out some of the important places to see. And interestingly enough, these are the places that are now discovered, that have been discovered by St. Helena in a way, and remarked as Christian and as holy and worthy of Christian attention and meditation. And it's important also then to realize is that a lot of these places that are now holy are or will become churches or basilicas. They're not simply archaeological sites, let's put it that way. You know, they're not, oh, we just discovered this, you know, ancient spot. No, these are sacred places. And that, I think, is the essential key to stress here.
Now, Dr. Doss, as we turn our attention to the influence of Jerusalem and the See of Jerusalem on the liturgy of the church, I'm reminded of a line from The scholar Julianne Smith, in her article, My Lord's Native Land, Mapping the Christian Holy Land, and she writes in that, quote, maps are shaped by landscapes and mindscapes. Maps are shaped by landscapes and mindscapes. So what do we know as the, well, as the Roman persecutions have ebbed away for the time of Constantine, although they'll make a comeback briefly with Julian a little bit down the line, but as the church has a bit of breathing room, we'll say, what is the influence of Jerusalem, of its liturgy, of its customs in mapping, shall we say, the Christian liturgical year?
I think the influence is huge, personally. I think, and I'll explain why I say that. But it's a very interesting concept that Smith brings up, this idea of landscape and mindscape. And this is what we hinted at earlier in our discussion, is that where geography becomes more than simply location, but it becomes sacred. And that sanctity of place is not through some connection or plug into, you know, into energies, but rather a way to meditate and go outside the physical. She refers to it as mindscape. I would really prefer to call it more spiritual scape. You know, it's more of a process of the soul, as opposed to simply a way to understand what what this is. So I would suggest that we're not talking about the placement of ideas on physical reality, but rather the translation of physical reality into spiritual reality. And that's often a point missed by most academics, not to critique her, but I would like to make that difference, because then we easily become hyper-Platonic, hyper-Plato, it's all about the mind and the ideas, but this is also about the spiritual journey. And that, I think, is something that is often missed. But, I won't belabor the point, but the point, what I would like to get into is to suggest that when we're talking about these places, and we're talking about Jerusalem in particular, it's not simply going to be the radius from which the faith has emerged, but also the radius from which liturgy itself or the process of worship has emerged. And this is going to become one of the most focal, I think, most urgent points, especially when dealing with heresy, as we mentioned earlier. One of the most important focuses of the church, in the sense that what we term as the Mass or worship is a continuation rather than a break of the historical event that happened at this place. So what was going on in the Second Temple is the same thing that is now being done in the Mass. That concept is crucial here, that there is no disconnect happening here. And as such, what the descriptions we have, we don't have the Jerusalem liturgy as such, by the way, just when people are curious. We unfortunately do not have it, but we do have fragments of it located in different places that we can access. And these fragments are crucial in helping us understand what we're looking at. The Jerusalem liturgy is important also because it becomes, what's the best way to, I guess, the hub the root? That's a better way of looking at it. It's the root of all liturgies, of all masses, of all worship that the Christians will engage in from now on. Why I say that is from the detailed description that Egeria gives us, and that we can then trace in other places. What we discover is that the methodology of proceeding in worshiping God during Mass or through worship or whatever, that procedure that we have that we are so used to is first described for us as inherent in what is being seen and witnessed in Jerusalem, in the churches in Jerusalem, I should say. And why that, I think, is important is because perhaps it's something that Egeria is not used to seeing. And she's making a note of this, saying, oh, this is how they worship here. Isn't that interesting? Now, unfortunately, she never compares the two. She never says, oh, they do this here, and while we do this here. But she is so mesmerized and fascinated, I guess, or whatever the term would be, taken by the witness of seeing the Jerusalem liturgy, the Jerusalem Mass taking place in the church that she attends, that she makes a detailed record. But interestingly enough, thereafter, this process of becomes part and parcel of what we see in other churches throughout Christendom. And it's going to stay this way basically forever. So this idea of continuity is what we're really witnessing here. This is not some haphazard, oh, well, we just came up with this way to do this. No, there's a historical root here that is being excavated, that is being rediscovered, that is being analyzed, and it's being contextualized for us. And this context, this historicization, this rootedness of worship itself is what is key. Like I said, if we don't have all of the parts of the liturgy, of the Jerusalem liturgy that have survived, but from this witness, we do know that it's a very early one. It's a very, very early one. There are other early liturgies as well. This is the earliest. And we can also say this is probably the original one that we are witnessing.
And indeed, I believe it's Julianne Smith who writes in her article, My Lord's Native Land, that the memorable custom of using branches on Palm Sunday during the liturgy originates in Jerusalem at this time.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
Now, Dr. Duss, as we're at this point, there's this great awakening of pilgrimage sentiment. We mentioned earlier Saint Helena, and perhaps we can talk about the finding of the cross, as well as the import in memory of well, not Helena, but also Egeria, right? Of these being female pilgrims and this dynamic in pilgrimage.
Yes, it's interesting. You bring a very important point, and this is the whole, tradition of the role of women in the church, in Christianity, and so forth, that people have looked at, and unfortunately placed in the wrong context, which is modern feminism, which is not what we should be doing here. This is not about empowerment of women and so forth. Those terms that people love to toss about. But what we're really looking at is this idea that there is a particular aspect of holiness, of holy work, that is best undertaken by women. And what I mean by this, and I think this is something that Constantine hints at when he appoints his mother as the best person to look after this sort of thing, is that this is part of, in the Greek sense, of economy. oikonomia, the oikos, which is the home, management of the home, management of the Christian household. So what we're witnessing with these Christian women going on pilgrimage is not simply an expression of, early feminism, but, what we're really witnessing is far better, I think, the expression of Christian womanhood. What is a Christian woman and what does she do in this world? And that practice of Christian womanhood, something that we've completely lost, unfortunately, in our day and time, as opposed to, just to be fair, Christian manhood as well. So, what we're witnessing here is this idea that Christian women have a very particular economic role to play in the sense of building the household. So this idea of building is crucial here, because what is Saint Helena doing when Constantine sends her out? She's rebuilding that which has been lost. And this rebuilding process is best left to women, Christian women. We understand from this action. And it's something that I think Egeria understands from, if you read her account. And it's interesting that she is the one being sent out from this group in the Rhone Valley, wherever that is. She is the one that's been chosen to go out, not some guy down the road who is, who's got more money or something like that, but she's been chosen. And again, why? And I think this brings us back to this idea of Christian womanhood, what that is. And this Christian womanhood is closely related to Christian economy. And that, I think, is the crucial testament that we're witnessing here, testament to what Christian womanhood is all about. And also, I would like to suggest is that what we're witnessing here through these two accounts, Egeria and Helena, is that we are witnessing this idea of history as reconstruction. And because history is reconstructed, it should have a moral component. It isn't some kind of, some agenda or some, something that you just do. But history is done for a different purpose than simply, recording things that happened in the past, i.e. history has a sacred obligation. And here we're going to get to this idea of what sacred history is all about as well. And it's interesting that sacred history is left in the care of women. Of Christian women, I should be careful today, nowadays. It's left in the care of Christian women, which I think is the crucial point here. That Christian women have a very interesting and important part to play in this entire process. So that's what I would suggest with both Egeria and St. Helena in their roles. And there are others, of course, later on as well, other women who are going to be participating in this process. But these two are the earliest in that regard.
And, in that article I've referenced a few times from Julianne Smith, there's this line that she says that Christians had retained few links to Palestine before Helena's journey. And, one of the things that impresses me, and I want to use as we transition to monasticism in the Holy Land at this time, and we're going to use a quote by St. Augustine here. And I think at the same time, how striking it is that with Augustine, his mother, Monica, and perhaps you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Helena also had rather humble circumstances early in life. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. There's a bit of confusion, unfortunately, about Helena. People think that she might have been a daughter of a British king and was probably born in Britain, but it's probably not true. And it's probably that she was from humble origins, from the area of Dalmatia, and she was probably a barmaid, someone who worked in an inn, that sort of thing. So very humble, for sure. She wasn't, high born as such. So yeah, likely she was, a barmaid, in Dalmatia.
So very striking, not just the memorial of the women, but also from mean origins, whether that's Helena or Monica at the same, roughly the same time period. As we transition to monasticism, we've talked about the liturgy, I'd like to use a selection from the second lesson on St. Lawrence's Day. Now, this is from St. Augustine, and he's talking to people in the post-Constantine Tinian period, and his audience apparently is very bummed out that it can't be martyred anymore. And there's this real feeling of, oh, we've lost out. And so Augustine reassures his audience that it is not true that the bridge was broken after the martyrs crossed. It is not true, nor is it true that after they had drunk from it, the fountain of eternal life dried up. And so, you know, Augustine's writing at this very time period, and there's this discouragement, like, oh no, that opportunity for heaven is lost. And Dr. Doth, can we talk about the development of monasticism and indeed monasticism in the Holy Land as, I don't know if you want to say a substitute for martyrdom, maybe we can or not, that's I'd like your thoughts on that, but maybe a sublimation of martyrdom or a living martyrdom at this time period?
Yes, it is certainly a living martyrdom. And it certainly is a replacement in that regard. But I would be careful to say that it's a substitute for martyrdom because martyrdom does continue and it becomes, you know, something, theologically it becomes something different from this early time period. But what I would like to say or suggest about monasticism, and it is from this area that it's going to develop, basically Egypt actually, it's an Egyptian concept. And it's going to have very far-reaching effects because we have evidence, for example, very early on from Ireland of Egyptian monastic practices that are not, preserved elsewhere. So we know about Egyptian monasticism within the Egyptian context, and then outside of it, we only encounter it in Ireland. So, you know, this idea of monasticism, again, like pilgrimage, spreads very fast and very wide. So, but what is it? What are we talking about when we refer to monasticism as such in this time period? Because it will develop and become other things as well later on. But the essential idea of what monasticism is, and of course, I say this because it's often misread by people who don't understand what monasticism is, unfortunately. And it's often misread as something, you know, selfish that people do just to save themselves and that sort of thing. And here I would say it's a different, we have to be very careful about monasticism and martyrdom because martyrdom is also confused with that notion of, oh, these people were so eager to get themselves killed to go to heaven, which, you know, which then brings in this idea of suicide and all this sort of, you know, there are theological complications that come up. So we have to be very careful with our terminology. So what I would suggest is that monasticism at this time, you know, becomes, like I said, something else as well later on. But at this time, it's a process through which individuals who want to, you know, who choose, it's an election, it's not something forced at this time, who choose to separate themselves from the process of civilization. What does that mean? Very simply is that monasticism at this time understands that the best way to achieve human civilization on this planet is not through political means, something that we've forgotten, but rather through spiritual means, i.e. civilization is going to be a consequence of holiness. If you have holiness, you will have good civilization. If you have zero holiness, you will have zero civilization. And that balance or that relationship is what this early monasticism is all about. And this is why it rails at kings and politicians and et cetera, et cetera, the rulers of the day. And it is very hard, it's the harshest critic of the world because it understands at this very early time that its job is not to be hand in glove with, you know, the local politician. Its job is to rail against the world so that the world will correct itself. And the railing can only come through holiness, through self-holiness. So the person who rails shouldn't be some empty-headed fool who just is, you know, miffed at the world. But rather, this critique or the railing against the world should come from a very holy place, i.e. through extreme self-discipline, through extreme self-reflection, and through extreme self awareness of what this is all about. So if you read collectively the church fathers, and especially the ones that are hermetical, what we're getting at is a vision of the world as a consequence of holiness. This is what this is all about. So people go into monasticism not as some kind of selfish way to save themselves and, you know, the heck with the world approach, though it's often misunderstood as such, but rather as a way to correct the world. So monasticism is the check and balance system of the excesses of the world. And what's the best way to do it? Well, to be completely outside of it, not to be part and parcel of the political system, but to be completely outside of it and represent the city of God. Because it's only the city of God, as St. Augustine is going to, you know, tell us and is telling us at this time, it's only the city of God that can correct the human city, the city of politics. So, and that relationship between the city of God and the city of politics, it what needs constant fine-tuning. Otherwise, you have serious evil on your hand. And that's, in a nutshell, is early monasticism at this time period. And this is how they understand themselves as well. And I think that concept has never really been lost, though it has been misunderstood and often misapplied and misused. That's a different story we can get into. But that's, at this time, this is what we're witnessing and coming through in the monastic traditions.
And, you know, at this time, we think back to previous episodes, we know that Origen and Rome certainly had a time to spend with the monks in Palestine. And speaking of railing at the powers that be, I'm about Palestinian and Syrian monasticism, I'm impressed at the poems by Alfred Lord Tennyson to this effect. Anyone who's interested may enjoy reading Saint Simeon Stylites about a monk in this part of the world who stood on a pillar for many, many years as a penance. Literally, I know Dr. Das was using it figuratively, standing outside the world, but he literally stood outside the world on a pillar up on 20 feet in the air. And then also a separate poem. So one poem is called Saint Simeon Stylites, and one is called Saint Telemachus, about a monk who travels from Palestine and Syria to throw himself in the amphitheater and make a point to stop, and so it does the games.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Those are two great poems. Yeah.
The last topic I wanted to bring up, Dr. Das, in this episode, and of course I invite you to bring up any afterwards, but is this great, we're talking about, you know, the concept of the Holy Land and mapping in the minds of the faithful the Holy Land as a special place of remembrance of, to use the liturgical word, amanesis, this liturgical remembering, but, you know, also remember, you know, travel and that kind of cosmic appreciation for it. But the last thing I wanted to bring up is this idea of monks as human markers, as almost in the Holy Land at this time of, well, can we tease out what that might mean? Monks as human markers. I think we could take that in different directions, but maybe I'll throw it to you and we can toss it back and forth.
Yes. When we're talking about monasticism and what monks do and what, you know, what they don't do, what we're looking at, and I think this is going to help us understand what this means as monks as markers, is that they are gauging the process of holiness. We can look to monks and monasticism, the monastic tradition, in order to correct ourselves, because most of us are not monks, it's the map, it's the guide, monasticism, of what true Christian life is all about, which is total and utter devotion to God and neglect of the world. That old saying, we live contra mundum, it's always against the world that we are taught to live and expected to live. And so monasticism, as this term, monasticism, monks as markers, or monasticism as a marker, is that which is unchanging in the process of faith. We change, we do all kinds of things. We compromise with the world, we negotiate with the world. We do things that we want to do and make us happy, et cetera, et cetera. We're always in a position of compromise and negotiation when we live in the world. This is St. Paul saying, live in the world, but don't become like the world. That's monasticism. That's a definition of, that's a summary, by the way, of monasticism, in the words of St. Paul. But what monkhood or what monasticism does is that it provides us an unwavering standard that doesn't change. It's always going to be about getting up early in the morning and praying. It's always about ora et labora. It's always work and prayer. And that is what Christian life on this planet is all about. Of course, we all as Christians forget all that. But it's like, having the North Star, saying, okay, I'm kind of lost. How do I get my bearings again? Well, you look to monks and monasticism. That was the role of monasteries up to the medieval time. They were role models of the ideal Christian life. And it's a life that most of us could not live up to. And it was a way to understand how far we are from reality, Christian reality, of what life is all about. So I would suggest that we understand this term, whether the author meant it as such, I'm not sure. But this is how we as Christians can understand the process of monasticism and monks, which is that they are the standards that don't change of Christian life, which is utter and total dedication to Christ. Christ is very famously said, if you love me, obey my commandments. Which means what it means. No negotiation, no real discussion with the world. But of course, we do that all the time. So up to the Middle Ages, and this is, we're talking about the early Middle Ages, or late antiquity with this, with the, the time period we're involved in right now, but it's the beginning of the Middle Ages. But it's a system that, persists right up until the Reformation. And that is that monasticism is a fundamental part of civilization. And this is something we've lost, this idea we've lost. Monasticism is some kind of, weirdos or something, that are people who just, give up on sex and drugs and drinking and somehow, live in a convent and say it's a better world or a better life. We don't understand this because we've negotiated away our Christian life for the world, life with the world. But in the proper sense of monasticism, and especially at this early time when monasticism is being established, it is the way to live for a Christian. It is the standard. It is the gold standard of the Christian life. It's something that we all need to aspire to according to this mentality and time period. This is why, for example, in the Middle Ages, you often have instances of kings when they get old, or nobles and so forth, giving it all up and going off and becoming monks. It's a very, it's a trope. It's a literary trope almost of the rich man, the wealthy man, the king, the potentate, the noble saying, okay, enough, I'm just going to go become a monk, giving it all up. And most of the famous monks did come from rich families. St. Francis, for example, his father was a very rich merchant. So they didn't come from poor, humble backgrounds. They did come from privilege. They did come from this, but they the ideal of the Christian life was not in the world. It was this. So this is what monasticism is. So monks as markers, I would suggest as a summary, is markers of the perfect Christian life on this planet, on this earth.
And I'm, of course, impressed, and I remember the tale of Mary of Egypt, right, trying to seduce all the pilgrims at this very time period, going to the Holy Land and getting getting something she didn't envision, which is a conversion herself on pilgrimage. And then what a great setup is this type of archetype or trope even for, you know, at this very time period of you know, the conversion of heart, right, in Mary of Egypt, with the topic of pilgrimage and linking it to monasticism, a great image for us.
Yes, exactly. And monasticism, right until the Middle Ages, is a very, very powerful force. It is going to be structuring all of society. We often forget the importance monasticism has in Christendom, in Christian history, in the history of the West, let's put it that way. Everything that we think is important about the West is a monastic consequence or a monastic tradition. Education, medicine, etc. You know, some of the most important things go back to monasticism.
Well, Dr. Donna, we're at about 45 minutes here. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up as regards Jerusalem, pilgrimage, monasticism, this sort of thing?
Very quickly, I would suggest is that to bring it all together, that, you know, this, all these various things we've been talking about, what I would suggest is that when we're looking at all these various things, we looked at, you know, pilgrims, travelers, the Holy Land, the invention of the creation, I should say, of sacred space, of Christian sacred space. What this is suggesting is that for us today, you know, why are we doing this? Why are we looking at all this stuff aside from, you know, interest? What I would suggest is that these are still important standards that we should begin to, or we should relearn to live up to. Just as St. Helena went out and relearned or rediscovered that which had been lost, so we too, who have lost a lot as Christians in the world, in the, you know, 21st century, we should use these examples to rediscover that which we have lost. If we don't do it, if we don't use these examples as a way to further our own spirituality, we unfortunately become the worst kind of historians, which is that we make history into a fossil and nothing more. You know, a piece in the curiosity cabinet that we take out, oh, and look at it, oh, isn't that interesting, and then put it back again. That is not the way to do history. That is not what history is all about. But history is about self-correction. And we should understand this process of self-correction. I think this is what St. Helena was doing. This is what Egeria was doing, the Bordeaux traveler pilgrim was doing. The monasteries for sure are doing. And we need to rediscover that dynamic because we've lost that dynamic so much so that we've become tyrannized. And by that, I mean, we've replaced everything in life with politics. And that, I think, is a very sad state of affairs, where politics engenders all or is all of life. And that is what we should get away from as not simply, you know, human beings, but certainly as Christians. And because we have a higher standard. And why I say a higher standard? Because it has great, you know, yielded better results than what we've been creating with our preoccupations. So I would, as a summary, I would suggest that we go back to that early energy of rediscovery, of realignment to faith, realignment to what this is all about, and the real purpose of living, you know, living on this planet.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Das, what can we, speaking of discovery, what can we discover in the Postville this month? What are some articles that we might want to keep an eye out for?
We've been looking at some really interesting things. Actually, there are some really interesting three book reviews that are quite interesting in the October issue, which I would encourage people to look at. And these reviews are looking at what we've been talking about, which is the relationship of politics and faith, for lack of a better term. How far can politics take us? Is politics the be-all and end-all of life? So these three reviews are very interesting in that regard. I would really encourage people to take a look at them, the three book reviews. And in the future, the November issue that's going to be coming up soon, which is really interesting, we're going to be looking at, interestingly enough, the role of the UN from a person who works at the UN. And this is going to be very, very interesting. Again, in a historical perspective, and I would encourage people to come back in November when we get those articles out and up to look at what this is all about, because we hear this term a lot, the UN and so forth, and it's good to know from an insider what this is all about. So do look forward to that in November.
Excellent. And if anyone is interested in studying the Western humanities in an integrated and thorough and formal fashion, please check out apostasiasinstitute.wordpress.com. And then concerning this series, Christian History and Ideas, if any of you kind viewers have suggestions, perhaps correspondence that you'd like to pass our way, or maybe an article you'd like us maybe to speak on, or even volunteer yourself if you're especially versed on the type of subjects we talk about in this series, perhaps to be interviewed. Any of this and all of this can be sent to us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. And Dr. Doss's site, The Apostle, Apostasis, and indeed the address I just mentioned, will be in the description of this video on BitChute and on YouTube as well. So with that, Dr. Doss, thank you so much for your expertise.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure as always to be here and talk to you.
And thank you, viewers, for your interest and for watching. Take care now.
Take care.